Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'm really thrilled today to introduce to you and to share with you, actually, the experience of a distinguished panel of American observers who participated at overseeing the presidential elections that took place in Syria on June the 3rd. Side by side, of course, with other observers who came from all over the world, too many countries sent observers and monitors to make sure that the presidential elections that took place in Syria were genuine and that these elections applied the international standards of multipartism, which is, as you know, a basic pillar of democracy. That was the first experience ever in Syria for quite some time, maybe since the 60s of last century. And this is why this experience is indeed and should be a matter of deep reflection of the journalist accredited to the United Nations as well as to all those who are keen interest in knowing what really happened in Syria. Of course, while speaking about the presidential elections, you may have other questions related to what we call, commonly speaking at the United Nations, the Syrian crisis prevailing right now. All these reflections and questions are legitimate, and I guess, and I'm quite sure, let me say, that our guests will have the appropriate and suitable answers to all these questions. I would like to thank Anka for participating and hosting this this meeting. I hope it will be useful, as expected, of course, by all of us. And my thanks also go to the Secretariat of the United Nations for facilitating the holding of this press conference. The panel of experts and observers include distinguished experts, as I said, Mrs. Judy Bello, welcome, Dr. Paul Laroude, Mr. Joseph Losbaker, and Mrs. Jane Stillwater, and Mr. Scott Williams. Without any delay, I would like and I would prefer to give them the floor so that we give them enough time to give you the right picture of the Syrian landscape that was prevailing during the elections. They are eyewitnesses, and they will tell you about their own experience in this very important event in Syria. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Judy Bello, and I'm an anti-war activist and a blogger from upstate New York. I came to Syria to better understand the impact of the Western-backed war on Syria and the Syrian people. I wanted to see firsthand the people's engagement with the election and to hear some stories that I could relate on my blog. And I did bring back some wonderful insights from ordinary people that I'm publishing. Observing the popular support for the Syrian election was a moving experience for me. The people voted with their hearts. Here in the West, there's no impediment to voting, and yet little more than 50% of the population generally vote, and most of us do so out of a sense of obligation. The overwhelming response of people inside and outside of Syria sent a powerful message to the world of loyalty to their country and to the government that is currently safeguarding it. As we all know, Dr. Bashar Assad won the election by a landslide. More important, though, than the 88% of the vote that he won was the 73% of the population who actually voted. Given that there were those who claimed to be boycotting and people in areas too violent to open a voting booth, and that the diaspora in Europe and the United States were barred from voting at local embassies, 73% was a pretty good number for what amounted to a referendum on the president's governance. In fact, it was quite astounding. Those who are prosecuting this war on Syria and their facilitators should understand that their war has not only failed to win the hearts and minds of the people of Syria, but it has failed to break them. And to the people of Syria, I want to say that I wish you peace and a just resolution of your travails and the prosperous future that you deserve. Thank you.
My name is Paul Larudi. I'm a piano tuner, former academic and government advisor from Northern California. I'd like to say that I found the Syrian election to be an extraordinary affirmation of the will of the Syrian people. Although the outcome was never in doubt, Syrians abroad overwhelmed their embassies or flew thousands of miles for the opportunity to vote. In Syria, they came to the polls in vast numbers to demonstrate their support. I observed the election in the city of Homs, where the turnout was huge and enthusiastic, despite threats of attack from the armed opposition. Homs has been called the capital of the revolution, and the center of the city had been freed from opposition control less than a month before the election. Nevertheless, the voting was peaceful and the turnout heavy. It may be useful to compare the Syrian and Egyptian elections. In both cases, the outcome was certain. But in Syria, the turnout was twice as great, even though many of the refugees were unable to vote in other countries, and parts of Syria were in the control of occupation forces. Clearly, the Syrian people intended to send a message that they support their current government. Well, we got that message.
Good morning. My name is Joe Osbaker. I'm an activist with the Anti-War Committee in Chicago, and I'm also part of the leadership of the United National Anti-War Coalition. We are the organization that organized the protest when NATO's summit was held in Chicago. That protest with 15,000 people was the largest anti-war demonstration in the United States since Barack Obama became president. I was one of two national coordinators for that demonstration. I want to say that the Syrian people are truly an inspiration to me. They have withstood this terrible war brought to their country by my government and its allies. I also observed the election in Homs, where the death toll has been in the thousands. And in fact, 1 week after our visit there on election day, 1 week later, there was a car bomb that targeted civilians. And, you know, that was exploded by the foreign-backed right-wing rebels. In one of the polling places, I spoke with a medical student, a 22-year-old woman, who wants to be an ophthalmologist, like her president, Bashar al-Assad. She and her young friends were confident that the Syrian people would go forward and rebuild their country. The U.S. government denounced the election before it was held. And as Paul said, the governments that are behind the war in Syria closed the embassies so Syrians abroad could not participate. But I think the measure of this election was taken when we were in Beirut in the days before the 3rd of June, when hundreds of thousands of Syrians lined up, drove miles, walked miles in order to participate. We met on our first morning with the head of the Electoral Commission in Syria, and he told us that they had only printed 200,000 ballots for Beirut, and they ran out. And the Western media was shocked. They were stunned by these refugees. And these things together, my experiences together, showed me what I believe these elections represent. They are, number one, a defeat for the United States, for NATO, for the Zionists and the Gulf states, and a victory for the Syrians. Thank you.
My name is Jane Stillwater. I was a war correspondent in Iraq with the Marines in Anbar province and also with the Army in Baghdad in the Green Zone. And my statement is here on the press thing, and I think everybody here has said the elections were valid, legitimate, no question. So what I'd like to take this opportunity to address the elephant in the room, ISIS. When I was in Syria, I found that the Syrians were totally against ISIS, and they were totally shocked. And now, on the news here, I'm hearing that the Islamic militants have come out of Syria. First, these aren't Syrians. Syrians fought ISIS. And second, every time I hear Islamic militants, I cringe, because ISIS is not Islamic. The ISIS members, they do not act like Muslims. They are not Muslims. Muslims are compassionate and just, and justice means a lot to them. They are no more Muslims than Hitler was a Christian. Muslims, ISIS main modus operandi in Syria and in Iraq is to move into a city or town, kill or drive out the civilian population, and then loot and slash and burn like pirates. And the same thing happened in Mosul, where apparently the first thing that ISIS and other quote-unquote Islamic militants did was to loot the central bank of $500 million while flying the black and white Jolly Roger. And ISIS doesn't want to capture Baghdad either. It was after the oil refinery, and it just captured the oil refinery. ISIS doesn't want to convert people to Islam. All they want to do is show me the money. And these are the people that America is backing. And American taxpayers are paying billions to weaponize and train these crooks and robbers. And Bush and Cheney were the bluebirds, Bluebeards. He's a famous captain, a pirate captain who was just totally slash and burn. They are the Bluebeards who gave birth to ISIS. And President Obama is no Captain Jack Sparrow either.
Great, thank you. My name is Scott Williams, and I'm an organizer with the International Action Center, and I'm based in Philadelphia. So I visited Syria to observe the 2014 elections, along with ministers of parliament and dignitaries from 32 countries across the world in every continent. And on election day, I observed many polling places across Sweda, which is in the southern part of Syria. What I saw opened my eyes to the reality of war and the resilience of the Syrian people. One of the young women I talked with for quite a while in Sweda described her experience, her everyday experience, with the U.S.-funded war as a daily nightmare. It was like living in a horror movie. She described just brutal scenes. Despite this reality, Election Day in Syria was a nationwide day of celebration, absolutely. On June 3rd, over 9,600 polling places, including in places like Aleppo, were open, and in cities across Syria, thousands of people were in the streets. And we saw this in all the different cities, in Tartus, in Homs, in Damascus, in Ceuta, and all across the country where we visited. And these people were proclaiming their own victory with this election. This was a victorious moment. This election was truly an expression of the will of the people of Syria, unlike the fraudulent elections across the region and here in the United States and Europe. The massive turnout of over 73% of all Syrian adults speaks to how millions of people in Syria want peace, democracy, and sovereignty. No matter how many U.S.-built bombs drop, or no matter how many U.S.-paid mercenaries enter the country, there are now over 11,000 Syrians who are ready to defend their country, and that's what they did peacefully this time by voting in this election, and including actually up to 15 million people, honestly, over 15 million people. Lastly, as a young person growing up in the United States, my entire conscious life has been one of U.S. wars of aggression in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, and now in Syria, and you could mention other countries. Based on watching these events, it is clear to me that the U.S. weapons, troops, and support for regime change and so-called democracy has led to nothing but chaos and misery for millions of people. Despite this, the Syrian people are a tremendous inspiration of how to fight back against this and win. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Michelle Nichols. I'm a reporter with Reuters. On behalf of the UN Correspondents Association, thank you for doing this interesting briefing. In the interests of transparency, can you tell us who approached you to visit Syria and how your trips were funded, who paid for them? And also, Ambassador, if I may, I have a couple of questions for you. Did you approach any journalists here at the UN to visit Syria to observe the election as well? And on the humanitarian resolution that's currently being negotiated by the Security Council, Ambassador Cherkin told us yesterday that Syria has agreed to open up 4 border crossings from Iraq, Turkey and Jordan to allow the delivery of more aid under a formula that Russia has proposed. Could you tell us sort of exactly what you've agreed to on that? Thank you.
What I can say is that our group, the group that I'm affiliated with, the Syria Solidarity Movement, was seeking actually to avail itself of the proclamation from Syria that it was interested in having observers come and that it was inviting observers from various nations. The connection finally came through. We were trying various means of availing ourselves of that and getting the necessary visas and so forth. But there's a contact of mine and of several of us who participated in the Global March to Jerusalem some years ago. He's in Iran. He's a Kashmiri, actually, though. And he was the one who managed to set up this connection with the Syrian government in order to make it possible for the visas. And his organization is called the International Union of Unified Ummah. And that was the organization that made contact with the Syrian government to arrange for the visas and so forth.
For all of us.
This was a nonprofit in Iran that funded that. They didn't pay for all of it. We also contributed from ourselves. Right. It was funded actually by several nonprofits, including the Syria Solidarity Movement, the International Action Center, and the Syrian American Forum.
I think that's exhaustive.
My bank account is wrecked, and it was worth every minute. The Syrian people are just amazingly wonderful. All of you, get out of your seats right now. Go off to Syria.
Well, I wouldn't miss this opportunity to thank the Syrian American Forum also for making a huge effort, actually, for the organization of this meeting today, this briefing at the United Nations headquarters. You have just heard the Dr. Larudi that how they sponsored their trip to Syria. You asked me whether I, as an ambassador to the United Nations, have done anything with this regard. I would tell you immediately no. Although I would have been proud to do so if I was required to. I mean, this is the job of the ambassadors accredited to the United Nations. This is the job of good ambassadors wherever they serve their country. We need to facilitate building bridges between countries, between governments, between cultures. Otherwise, we wouldn't be real diplomats fulfilling these very noble and lofty tasks we are entrusted with. However, we were extremely happy to receive these distinguished members of the American panelists in Syria. They were an important part of a much bigger component of international monitors and observers who decided to come to Syria willingly to know and to observe with their own eyes what's going on over there. The Syrian situation is not exclusively restricted to the elections. So this is why these gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, had the opportunity to touch upon different aspects of the Syrian landscape, if I may say so. So they came back to their country with a deeper knowledge of the situation prevailing in Syria as well as in the area, as Madame has just elaborated a little bit on Daesh, ISIS activities, both in Syria and Iraq. More we know what's going on in Syria, better it is for the what we call the international community. Better it is for the Syrian-American bilateral relationship. This country is huge, as you know, but it is generous with this kind of ladies and gentlemen who defied all kind of restrictions and who decided to go to Syria to see what's going on over there and to get back to tell the American public opinion what they saw. So we should thank these people. We are grateful to them. And now with regard to the... before I move to the draft resolution, much of the misunderstanding between the Syrian government and the American administration relates to the lack of communication, to the absence of diplomatic American representation in Damascus. You know that Washington decided to shut down the American embassy in Damascus, so they don't have a professional source of information from Damascus. And every time we have the opportunity to open up any window towards Washington, somebody decides to boycott this opportunity, to shut down this possibility, as if some heavyweight in the American administration have no interest whatsoever to hear the voice of the Syrian government and to let this voice be heard by the American public opinion. You know, I'm a diplomat. I'm serving my country. I'm proud of doing so. In spite of that, I was restricted in my movements in the United States. I cannot go beyond 25 miles radius. I don't know why. They never told me, by the way, why. But we don't do that with diplomats. A great country such as the United States wouldn't be scared of a diplomat. I mean, in this era of technological revolution. So something is wrong with the American approach towards the Syrian situation. Now back to the draft resolution. Yes, indeed, there is a draft resolution examined carefully by all the stakeholders, including myself on behalf of my government. Yes, we are working seriously on doing something substantive with regard improving the humanitarian assistance access to Syria through some agreed-upon crossings with the neighboring countries. The deliberations have not finalized yet. We are working very closely with all the stakeholders, namely speaking the P5 and the Troika, Australia, Luxembourg, and Jordan, on the best means and ways to implement a neutral, impartial, non-politicized draft resolution on helping the Syrian civilian population who are in need of assistance. However, I don't know when this draft resolution would be tabled. I think maybe at the end of this week, maybe not. I don't know. However, we have to be to keep in mind some facts, such as number one, some of the stakeholders, as I said, the Troika, mainly speaking, but also United States and Britain and France. Some of them are deeply involved in the Syrian crisis, as you know. But to limit my remarks to the humanitarian aspect, I would tell you something that might surprise most of you. Australia, Luxembourg have been working very closely in the field of what we call humanitarian aspect of the Syrian crisis since they became non-permanent members in the Security Council almost a year and a half ago. For 1 year and a half, I kept asking the two ambassadors, who are my friends, the two ambassadors of Australia and Luxembourg, if you are so concerned with the humanitarian situation in Syria, would you please make a humanitarian gesture rather than the rhetorics and the draft resolutions? They asked me what kind of gesture. I said, could you please send wheelchairs, just wheelchairs, for the handicapped, those who became disabled because of the bloodsheds over there. I asked them only and exclusively to send wheelchairs and some ambulances, why not? For a year and a half, they escaped answering this request. Of course, I knew in advance that they wouldn't do it, but I was testing them, testing the waters, as we say. And they failed in the exam. I'm saying this, I'm giving you this example just to let you know that speaking about the improving the humanitarian situation in Syria is something, and doing something on the ground is something else. So we hear a lot of talks in the Security Council. People sometimes tend to cry when they speak on the floor in the Council. But when we ask them to do something, concretely speaking, they don't do anything except helping the terrorists and the armed groups with what they call lethal or non-lethal weapons. And we have seen recently how the lethal and non-lethal weapons in Iraq ended up in the hands of ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. So we have to be, we have to have deeper thoughts about what's going on in the area. By the way, ISIS is just a slight detail in the geopolitical landscape prevailing in the area. The media focuses on ISIS, but the issue is not ISIS. The issue is who is behind ISIS, who is protecting ISIS, who is helping ISIS, sponsoring ISIS, training ISIS, giving ISIS the opportunity to cross our border and penetrate our sovereignty and the Iraqi sovereignty. This is the issue. Otherwise, ISIS is not a story. It's not worth it. This issue is very very important. I wouldn't take much of the panelists' time. I would prefer to give them the floor back so that they would allocate much of their conversation.
If you mind.
Our relationship?
No, explain. You're saying there's a lot behind this, so please elaborate.
You don't know who is behind ISIS?
Please. Give
Do you know or you don't know? No. If you don't know, I would explain. If you know, I would explain also. ISIS is part of Al-Qaeda. It's an offshoot of Al-Qaeda that emerged in Iraq in 2007 after the American-British invasion of Iraq. So somehow ISIS is the outcome of the American-British invasion of Iraq. Like all kinds of extremism in the area, starting with the Zionism in Palestine, which triggered a radical extremist reaction in the area for quite some time. However, if you go through the Western media, starting with CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the French journal Le Monde, etc., etc., Der Spiegel, you name it, the Independent, Wall Street Journal. All of them, till now, to this very moment, they don't describe ISIS as terrorist entity. They call it militants. They call them Sunni jihadists. They call them revolutionaries. They never call them terrorists. I have never heard any American reporter on CNN or elsewhere qualifying ISIS as a terrorist entity, although ISIS is enlisted in the Security Council list of entities sponsoring terrorism. So here we have some kind of hypocrisy, flagrant, blatant hypocrisy that we should question. Why people are not describing ISIS as terrorist? This is a question.
Ambassador, may I just interject here?
Please.
Actually, the mainstream media in the United States, for instance, has been calling
The mainstream media actually has, in certain circumstances, called the ISIS terrorists. So, including the Wall Street Journal. So can you talk about who's funding, who's backing them? Can you please go to that?
I have been following this issue very closely on the American mainstream media, as you said. I have never heard anybody speaking on CNN qualifying ISIS as terrorist. They call it militant. Go back to the...
Ambassador, I have to say the State Department calls ISIS a terrorist organization. Could you please talk to who's financing and backing ISIS as you see it?
Even the State Department, they don't use the term terrorist. I didn't hear it yet, at least yet. Saudi Arabia, the Gulf States, money, the petrodollar money, the Turkish intelligence, the so-called fatwa, professed by the retardated sheikh in the Gulf States. I know you don't speak Arabic, but if you follow the TV channels that broadcast from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Emirates, you would know what I'm talking about. You would hear astonishing testimonies by the sheikh, financed by the Gulf petrodollars, on how to kill every night, how to kill. One of these sheikh who broadcast from Saudi Arabia said recently, addressing his followers, "Guys, I will not be able to sleep tonight if you don't kill 300 Christians and 300 Alawites." This is what you hear 24 hours around the clock in these TV stations, broadcasting from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the Emirates. And one of them is based in London, by the way, one of these stations. So the picture is really tragic and dramatic, ladies and gentlemen. We should be realistic while approaching this issue. I know that you don't know all the details, but we are here to explain to you. That doesn't mean that there are no other aspects that we should care about. But all countries in the world have problems. Why we don't see an American branch of ISIS? Why there is no ISIS in America attacking Wall Street, attacking Times Square, the White House, the Pentagon? Why it is allowed over there and here it's not allowed? How come? How come we have only this area of the world, the Middle East, we have this kind of garbage exported to us from all over the world? Why we are obliged to receive criminals coming from Australia, from Britain, from France, Belgium? We killed last week 15 Malaysians. What they are doing in Syria? They came from Malaysia, what for? Is this about international law? I may have problem with this country or that country, but that doesn't justify any decision taken by me to send killers and fight and so-called jihadists to that other country. We have the right, as ladies and gentlemen said, we have the right to protect our own people, our own country, our own sovereignty. What's going on in Syria and Iraq is appalling, appalling, really. I mean, something unprecedented. And if we don't get the picture, that will never stop. And these terrorists, you will see them tomorrow in Washington, in London, in Paris. They are already there. In Australia. We never play with the terrorism. Thank you,
Ambassador. Sorry, may I follow up on the draft resolution? On the draft resolution. Okay, to the panel. Actually, what we heard from you on the elections, we heard your political position, maybe on Western media, as you said, or Islam, or the American administration. We didn't get any numbers from you. We didn't see any report. Do you have a report written somewhere or published, posted online? And we saw also a lot of media reports, like from Lebanon, that some voters, okay, I'll check this. Some voters voted twice or maybe three times. Have you seen these reports, and what do you have to say about them? Thank you.
Everyone who voted had to stick their finger in a pot of ink. And I'm not a Syrian. I didn't vote, but I stuck my finger in the pot of ink. And here it is, 10 days later, and you can still see the ink. So people couldn't vote two or three times. They were marked for at least 10 days. And
so is this your only, is this the evidence that you use in your report? Is this how you monitor?
We didn't do one report. We did individual reports because we're all individuals. And we all went everywhere. They went to homes. We went to Sueda. There are people that went to Aleppo. Judy went to
Tartus.
To Tartus, Latakia. We went all over Syria, and we all saw the same thing. People enthusiastically voting after 3 years of horror.
I should point out that there were almost half a million ballots that were invalidated for irregularities as well. And every election has problems of this kind. I don't know to what extent this was a problem. But in any case, it is typical with any election to question recount ballots and all this kind of thing if doing so will make a difference in the outcome. In this case, I think that's not an issue. But it's absolutely clear that there was, from our point of view, and I think we all said this, that there was an overwhelming obsession on the part of the Syrian people to participate in this election and to make their will known, and they certainly did.
I wonder if this feeling also applies
to the people, to the Syrians who live in the United States. Have you been in touch with these people? I mean,
as a matter of fact, I personally know several Syrians that in California who showed up in Syria, and there were many more from around the world who came as much as 10,000 miles precisely because they could not vote in the United States. They had to go to Syria in order to vote.
How about banning the Syrians from voting in European capitals, also New York and Washington, others? How does that reflect on the overall turnout for the elections, in your opinion, and on the results?
I don't think that the numbers of Syrians living in the NATO countries were that large, in terms of the total turnout. I think it was a much larger number of people would have been voting in the Gulf states had they been allowed to vote, but there the embassies were closed as well. On the floor where I stayed at the hotel in Damascus was a British woman. She holds several doctorates, and she took time off to come to Damascus, spent her own money because she could not vote in London. And she also was doing, she was visiting wounded soldiers in hospitals and things like that while she was there. But, and she came all the way there to vote for Bashar al-Assad. So
what message do you get from closing all the missions, be it in the Gulf or in Europe or the United States here?
Well, the United States declared the election in Syria invalid from the very outset. And I read several articles on my way to Syria that said that 40% of the people of Syria were living in areas where they could not vote because they were controlled by the rebels. But if you think about it, if you look at the numbers of the Syrian population, the conservative, even a conservative estimation of how many refugees there are, it actually appears that the numbers living in the rebel-held areas can't be more than 500,000. Perhaps less. So anyway, we could actually go over the numbers if you wanted to. But it was just from looking at the aggregate numbers of the election.
But there are many of those who probably fled from these areas and came to Damascus or Homs or settled in other parts of Syria. Did you notice that they were participating in the elections?
That's exactly the situation. Scott wants to go. Okay. Syria, within Syria, you have roughly 6 million displaced persons, and perhaps half that number outside Syria. That says something very significant, by the way. It says that Syrians prefer to stay in Syria as refugees in government areas, because almost all of them are in government areas. Maybe you'll find five outside government areas. Not many. And then to go outside Syria and become refugees. And that is because in government areas, they are being taken care of. It's very difficult. It's very crowded, the conditions. But everywhere that we saw, the Syrian displaced persons are being taken care of. And yes, they voted heavily, as far as we could tell. Where we saw refugees, they were definitely voting. And I would not be surprised if they voted for the government that's taking care of them.
You say the government taking care of them, not the refugee agencies, for example?
Some refugee agencies, but the government is doing a large part. And Syrian NGOs also are a large part of that.
Yes, I was in Tartus, and the war really isn't there, at least at the moment. But I met with people in a refugee camp, mostly people from Aleppo, and they were all very happily voting. And at least one woman talked to me and through my translator and, about her hopes that that the government would be able to liberate her city, eventually. And there were also, I took a walk with one of the bellhops from the hotel, and he, too, was a refugee from Aleppo. And he was now staying with relatives in Damascus. And he said, you know, he had lost everything. Essentially, he'd lost his home, but at least his family was intact. And he was grateful to be in Damascus. And he said that he had his political views and that perhaps in a better world, you know, things could open up more, but that as far as he was concerned right now, he was loyal to the government because the government was looking after the people.
Yeah, I was talking to people. The population of Damascus has doubled by most reports. If you think about it, that's over 6 million people living in the, you know, the oldest continuously civilized city in the world. That puts a lot of stress. And at the same time, we're talking about huge poverty and unemployment and the loss of factories and industries everywhere. And still, people are supportive of the government. I mean, what does that say? It's completely different. And just to point out more of the U.S. hypocrisy, you know, President Obama, in speaking to West Point last month at the graduation, talked on creating, you know, solving this crisis through a political process. How ironic that just weeks later there was an election in a political process where, if you look at the numbers here, 15.8 million people, that's every single adult. That's every person in Syria. There's only 23 million Syrians. 15.8 is every adult over 18. They're all eligible to vote, unlike the U.S. where you have to register in a particular place and many people don't vote and you need an ID and all this, these different problems that exist in the U.S. But despite all of that, these people are devoted to this political process that was developed through a reform of the Constitution in 2012 that opened up to this kind of election in Syria. And that is the will of the people of Syria, unlike what President Obama says about solving it through a political process, which doesn't involve the president, which doesn't involve, you know, the people that 88% of the population voted for. You know, it's clear hypocrisy. And I think that, though this really, as we said, you know, this election symbolizes, you know, that the people are ready to move forward for peace and for sovereignty. And I think that that really will spell the end of the U.S. efforts here.
Can you compare the this election, if any of you can, to the election held, for example, in Ukraine, where they said that 60% turnout was an overwhelming turnout? Or I know in Iraq, too, there were some areas that weren't permitted to vote. And while you were there, did you get any sense of the support that, for example, Ahmed al-Jarba or some of the outside ones? And I wanted to, on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access, thank you for this briefing, which has been more interesting than most that we get in this room. Thanks.
Thank you for your excellent question. To start at the end, there were people at every polling place who were there to support the other candidates. And these people are known to Syrians. They have positions in the current government, and one of them is in parliament, and I think the other one used to be. But they're essentially, my sense was that they're economic advisors to the president right now, and that people supported them as a sort of a gesture of how they'd like to see the economy lean, but they weren't ready to be moved away from the central balance of the government under this situation of being at war. And I think that when you talk about democracy, for instance, and the United States, for instance, wants to bring the Syrian National Council in and have people vote for them and call it a democracy, well, they don't know who they are. They are from outside the country. They're essentially they're saying bring in a technocratic government and call it democracy. But democracy doesn't operate like that. People, if they have reasons to care about their lives, are going to vote for someone they know who's going to do the best possible job. And most of the people who supported the other candidates said, well, I don't expect them to win, but not this time, but I would really like to see their policies enhanced by the government. So I think that this is the best possible democracy. The other thing I noticed was that they had a very meticulous plan. We spent an hour or so with the elections board. And but when it came down to these, say I went to a bunch of different polling places, some of which were in small towns, some of which was one was in a big cement factory, and it seemed very well organized. And the dock workers in Tartus, again, seemed very well organized. But like some of the places in Banyas were kind of chaotic. And they were, you know, attempting to keep order, but there were a lot of people in long lines, and they were milling around, and they were, you know. And so you could see, though, that the I don't see that this was a negative in a sense, because these people were excited about the first time. There were people that brought their child to place their vote in the box for them so the child would know that voting matters. And so there was a lot of excitement there. And I think that, you know, this is probably more meaningful than if you go, like when I go to vote and people stand silently in line, or maybe they're restless because they have to get back to work and they're annoyed, and where it's better controlled, but there's not all this heartfelt energy. So I'm... That's my impression.
Regarding your question on the comparison, Ukraine.
Oh, Ukraine! I knew there was something.
Yes.
Yeah. Just very. Do you want 90 seconds? Very briefly on Ukraine. The United States said a Kiev-sponsored election with 60% participation is legitimate, but in Donetsk and Luhansk, where they had 80 to 90% participation in their referendum, those are not legitimate. You know, I think it just speaks for itself.
All right, yeah. Just a very quick methodology question. How many polling stations were there open for voting in Syria? There are five of you. How many other observers were there in around Syria to observe the elections? To what extent were you or any others actually present and monitoring the vote counting at these various polling stations? And can you just give us a little sense of the methodology, please? Thank you.
Really quickly, there's 9,601 polling stations which were open across the country, which is a tremendous achievement considering this is a country at war. We monitored over 100, I think maybe up to 120 observers. We're not monitors, we're observers. And we observed the election. I would say each of us probably went to at least 10 or 15 polling places in different cities. And you can say that we were in groups of about 5 to 7 people. So I think that, yeah, that's kind of the basics. But
there were observers from South America, Uganda, et cetera. But nobody in all the observations that we did in Syria saw anybody pass a law where you weren't allowed to go to the bathroom while you were waiting in line, like they passed in Florida.
Okay.
Thank you,
everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.